are listening to a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To subscribe to this podcast, visit questformeaning.org or search for Church of the Larger Fellowship in the iTunes Store.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to this edition of The View. I'm Christina Rivera, and I'm one of the newest additions to the View hosting team. So bear with me as I get my bearings straight. And I'm going to let the other participants today introduce themselves. And then we'll talk a little bit about what we're going to be covering today. So I'm just going to go across my screen. Aisha, you want to jump in?
Hi, I'm Aisha Hauser, and I'm in Seattle, Washington.
Hi. Meg Riley. Today I'm in the Bay Area, Berkeley.
And our guests for today?
Hi, I'm India Harris. I'm usually in New York, but today I'm in Boston.
Hi, I'm Sana Saeed, and I am in Boston too.
And Sana and India, can you tell us a little bit about how you're connected to Unitarian Universalism? What roles you play?
Sure. I am the Director of Youth Programs at the First Church in Belmont. I'm also the intern minister for the UUMA, a part-time minister for the next 2 years. And I am a seminarian soon to graduate at Harvard Divinity School.
Bye.
And I am the Youth and Young Adult Program Coordinator at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation at Shelter Rock. Mm-hmm.
Welcome, everybody. Thank you so much, India and Sana, for taking time to be with us today. We're really excited. So today, as some of you may have been with us last week, where we started talking about the Loretta Falcon, and we got about halfway through our show. We had some technical glitches, and so I'd recommend, if you're coming to this for the first time via watching it on our YouTube channel taped, to go back and take a listener, take a see of the first episode from last week, because that'll kind of get you through the first part. And Annie Scott and Jessica York were our guests and kind of took us through how we got to decentering whiteness at Loretta Falcon. And they kind of talked a little bit about how the presenters were invited, how that all happened, and talked about what it felt like to be in the room at the time when the presenters were there. And but we didn't get a chance to really talk about how the gathered religious educators were able to pivot once we had that that moment in time. So today we're going to take a little bit of time talking about that. Since Sana and India were both in the room at Falcon, I definitely wanted to give you all an opportunity to say what that felt like, because it's definitely, you know, some of the hardest emotions I felt at Loretta Falcon in a really long time. And I didn't want to get right into the, you know, here's how we were able to overcome. I definitely wanted to give some time for us to, for the two of you to share kind of what that felt like in the room from Friday night through Saturday morning, if you wanted to speak to that a little bit.
Thanks, Christina. I can go first. I think for me, how I felt was I hadn't been back to Loretta in a very long time. I'd actually been attending more of the GAs regularly and finding our way home. So this was my first time back at Loretta in a couple of years, maybe since 2010 or something like that. My experiences in the past with Loretta were really great, and at being at the Falcon. So I think I come in with expectations that were based on my experience in the past, and those expectations were definitely not met at this Lareda. Being in the room on Friday night, I was really, I didn't really understand what was happening and why it was happening, the facilitators being present. And I'm, you know, I've seen the view from last week, so I know you've gone over all of that. And I think for me, being in the room at that point, I was feeling surprised, frustrated, disappointed. And I was one of the people that did get up and leave when the activity started. And it was a really hard thing to do, knowing that it was a very visual thing because people did see us leave. And I was really hyper aware of that personally. The next day on Saturday, I thought maybe, I had actually thought that they weren't going to be there on Saturday. So when I got into the room in the morning, I was like, oh my God, they're still here. So I did, I mean, I sat down and you know, I was actually like just sticking around with a bunch of people in the back, friends that I have, and doing group activities with them. And I remember sharing a story about my family, my brother's experience with deportation. And then someone else had shared a story about their experience with becoming a citizen. And so we were sharing these really personal and hard stories. And I think what led to more of a frustration was how there was this sense of feeling that the stories were being equated to being the same, like people's experiences were the same. And that wasn't true. And then you heard the outbursts and everything else that followed. So I think that was when everything kind of paused for me. I've had experience with nonviolence communication in the past with trainings, and I still find it a difficult concept. I find it to be a very silencing concept, but I'm open to seeing how it could work. But in this scenario in Lareda, it was not working at that point for me. So I had a sense of feeling that I was frustrated, but I also spent a lot of my professional development funds to go to Lareda. And I know that that was something that is still a lingering question, you know, it leaves lingering feelings in me because I invested a lot into a conference that I don't know if it really gave me the benefits that I wanted, besides the multicultural renaissance module afterwards. So.
And I think that that speaks to some of what we were talking about last week that Aisha had raised at that moment was just kind of what you ended with there was those different experiences in the room, right? Because the nonviolent communication was speaking to some folks in the room, but those folks that I was speaking to had almost no concept that it wasn't working for a whole group of other people. And that to me was one of the biggest aha moments at that moment was like, oh gosh, they can't even conceptualize that this isn't working. And so how do we do that? So, India, I wanted to give you a chance to.
So I also attended the programming on Friday night, and Sana and I actually walked out of the room together. I read and checked out the program beforehand. And I knew from initially looking at it that I really wasn't all that interested, despite any naming of identities for whom the presenters were or who was on the planning team or on the board. I'm like, the subject matter, right, is not of interest to me. And so, but I decided to go anyway to see if the presenters had a particular technique or style that would be helpful, you know, to use in my congregational context or, you know, in a wider context. And there was definitely immediately a sense of forced intimacy. And I was wondering, like, is this an approach because you're perceiving that the majority of the participants in the room are female identified? So you kind of want to start off with this, and you sort of given the option to opt out, although something that we talk about a lot is autonomy and self-determination. So I didn't actually need that invitation. However, we did decide to take it. And then we came back on Saturday morning and, you know, again, sticking around for a little while to see if it would take a different course. And I felt like the presenters were very much so talking down to us. And I know people were trying to explain that they were modeling the precepts of nonviolent communication in their facilitation style. However, I did leave about an hour in, so I was not actually in there for the shutting down of the programming, and I did come back once we went into caucusing. I think the most powerful experience for me was sitting in there with you all and talking with the board and working on how to hold people accountable, sort of the pre-work before you even get to reimagining the program. I think a lot of times we rush to find a solution or slap a Band-Aid on something when really we need to have a moment sort of being able to talk about what's happened, identify maybe harm that's caused in here, sort of a larger context, right? Because how can we have transformation if we don't have a lot of the background information? Why was this decision made? Multiple people actually asked beforehand that you all shift course, and now you're telling us sort of why it was challenging for you to shift course, right? And then have sort of an understanding of the burden that's then on folks who are deciding to volunteer their time to shift the programming around, which I also did not. I was there when, again, we were talking about what had happened, but I was not involved in the restorative communication circles.
I wanted to jump in because I really want to lift up, and I so appreciated, India, that you sat next to me when we first had that conversation with the board. Because I had named last week that I was upset, not out of pain, out of frustration, that, you know, I tried to, you know, speak to the board beforehand. And I know colleagues of color did, and we were ignored. And I actually said, why did you ignore us? But I remember you sitting next to me and just kind of, you know, rubbing my back. And it was just such a, you know, I so appreciated that because it was you acknowledged that I just needed, it was very calming. So I wanted to thank you because there was a lot of people in the room, you know, there were a lot of adrenaline, a lot of energy. And I think one of the things also, one of the gifts of that experience was within all that energy and emotion, because there was all different emotions in the room, we still held that space and we held that tension and we sat in discomfort. And that's my wish for Unitarian Universalism, because that is what many of our congregants are just unable to do, is it turns into blame, finger pointing, fixing it, you know, just what you said. So that was a really compelling and important part, is that we simply took the time to do that. So I just wanted to lift up that I appreciated your personal care, because we're friends.
And I think something that's really important is that this is something that our denomination is grappling with. In 2016, when we led a workshop on dealing with conflict with Reverend Natalie Fenimore and Megan Henry, we spoke, most of, I think all of us, were talking about direct communication, right? How to be able to name an issue that's going on and sort of what the fallout is when we don't speak directly to what the issues are, when we don't have a power analysis to locate sort of where the information and where the decision-making is in the room.
Yeah, amen to that.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that also the other thing, India, that I saw from you, from what you said, or heard from what you said, was that we did that first. Like, we didn't rush into the making it all better part. Because I think one of the narratives that I've heard come out of Loretta Falcon is how well we pivoted and how well we transformed. And I think that's important. But what I feel like, even just a couple months out from it, is getting lost is that accountability part. And that accountability part was both at that moment, but is ongoing, right? So it's not just something that can happen right there at that moment and then everything's fine. We were able to pivot and do new programming, but that accountability part will continue. And that to me is really important, that we don't lose that part that you talked about, that is so important, that because then you just fix it for that one time. You're not fixing it for forever. So thank you for circling us back to that.
Meg, you want to jump in? I know you wrote some in the chat.
Well, I was just, I wasn't there. I'm just listening and I'm just thinking, not only are you all bringing in your lived experience with various identities, but also the wisdom of religious educators who, in my experience, have done a lot of the best transformation. I mean, I've been around a long time. It was religious educators who brought Dr. Bill T. Jones first. It was religious educators who have done so much. And we've had other shows about power differentials and that kind of thing. But I'm really seeing a room full of educators here, as well as people, going through your own personal experiences, just the way you're talking about it and taking apart the pieces of what needs to happen. It's just, I love it. I love religious educators. I think the denomination very much undersells how much religious educators are the community organizers in our movement.
I triple second that. So one of the things I want to lift up is where to go from here in terms of the term decentering whiteness. I think it would be good if somebody can give an analysis of that or what that means.
Either of you want to take that?
Well, could you explain, Aisha, what you mean by it when you say decentering whiteness?
So I think one of the things that was happening, I'll use it in the context of Loretta, of the two different people having, or two, not even two, several people, different groups of people having different experiences with nonviolent communication, right? What I observed is the folks that had either no problem with it or were loving the experience in general, although there were a couple of folks of color who said they also didn't have an issue with it, were white. And so, because I think it caters to the norms of the dominant culture and the being polite and the tone policing, that's how I experienced it. I'm not a fan of nonviolent communication at all. And so I think that's kind of centering the norms of the dominant culture, which are Eurocentric, patriarchal, Puritan. I'm coming more and more in the last few years realizing how puritanical we are. So that's what I mean. And so recognizing that, what does it look like to, I think even disrupting the whole thing was an attempt to decenter whiteness. It wasn't just going along because this is what was already planned. So even just that was taking that away. But that's what I mean by it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes me think of Tama Okun's resource around white supremacy culture. And it sort of gives folks the examples, like some of the examples that you already listed. And I think us moving into caucusing really allowed, in term part of decentering, right, is allow folks to feel grief. I don't think that a lot of white folks on the basis of whiteness, not any of their other identities, but feel erased or feel as though something is not for them, right? And so to move into the caucuses gave them the opportunity to sort of, state and go through their grief around that. Because I was very clear in going to Loretta and seeing what the program was and seeing who the presenters were, that this was not a program for me as the person of African descent. We're talking about brave space. My cues for brave space are mostly gonna come from women of color, right, in those experiences, because that is where my identities rest. That's where sort of my joy is. And that's also where my mentorship and guidance is, right? And so I don't know if it even, you know, occurred to folks that having not only the nonviolent communication sort of, but folks who were going to present it in such a way really maybe made folks, people of color, or even white folks in the room feel like, you know, this is some aspect of this is not for me.
Yeah, well said. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think in terms of, you know, when we're talking about decentering whiteness, and that's one of the things that I said in the summary speech is we talk a lot about decentering whiteness, and I think that's important because I think it gives us a framework to say specifically what it is that we're trying to do and what we're trying to look at. But it also, in doing that, centers whiteness, like there by default, because you're saying you're decentering it, right? So you're putting it at the center, the thing that you're trying to work outwards. And so when I presented that perhaps we also need to be doing multicultural centering, taking what's at the margins and bringing it to the center, I think there was some pushback against the idea that if we could just make everything multicultural, then the decentering would happen naturally. And one doesn't necessarily follow the other from where I'm at. And so when we were talking about doing more multicultural centering, even at Loretta Falcon, and we pulled up the slide, I'm hopeful that and now I realize I need to be more articulated about it, is that people can see that it's a both and, that we need to do both, that while we are focused on the ways in which white supremacy work in our institutions and in our culture, that we also then need to focus on how we want to be, right? That it's not just enough to say how we don't want to be. And so that's the multi, and actually Terry, and I forgot to say that we actually have somebody behind the scenes. Terry is doing our tech today. And so she's gonna actually pull up the slide that we used at Loretta Falcon to talk about multicultural centering, so folks can see that. And explain what a summary speech is. So at the, about a month, a couple weeks ahead of Loretta Falcon, the Loretta Falcon planning team asks someone to be the summary speaker. And so that person is tasked with, at the end of Falcon, kind of wrapping up everything that happened or what the flavor of Falcon was. So I was asked to be the summary speaker. And had agreed to do that and had a kind of plan of how I wanted to do that. And as soon as we went into Friday evening, our facilitators, I knew my plan had gone out the window and that this was going to be a different kind of Loretta Falcon to do a summary speech for. So I think that the slide is up. And so what's on that slide is a lot. So as India had said, there is like a 5 or 6 page document that talks about characteristics of white supremacy culture. And it talks about what things to look for, like, you know, perfectionism, exceptionalism, all of the kinds of things that we really get so detailed into. But what a lot of folks forget is that there's also listed for each of those some antidotes and things that we can be working on to bring a more multicultural lens to how we work together. And so some of this, what's on the slide, are from that. Some of it are just things that I hold of value when I'm trying to do multicultural work in UU settings and elsewhere. So we said, you know, what is multicultural centering? What does that look like? And so some of these things are what I would hope that we're focused on as we're going through our work. It's, you know, who's most affected by the decision gets to make the decision. That, and this is a big one for you, use to embrace discomfort, like embracing conflict, that there's an expectation of mistakes, that we're going to mess up, and that's okay. And that discomfort that comes from that is okay, as long as we're willing to be in that together, right? And kind of to what I think Indian Sinha was saying was to be able to stay in that and not just say, oh, this person's wrong, this person's wrong, this person's wrong, and move on out. And I think that discomfort place is really, really important for doing this work together. Because, you know, if it was comfortable, we would have already done it, right? That part of it would have been fun. And also, because I think in our community, at least in my community of color, it's easier for me to experience conflict. Like, I can be upset with my family and or my friends or my circle of accountability and express that. And I still know that they love me and that I love them. So anybody else have any comments about that? Because I think it's kind of...
Santa and I were at a training in June in Boston. I don't know if you remember this, Santa, but Marisol Caballero and I just had a discussion kind of across the room. And one of the facilitators, white man, said, oh, well, things are getting heated. And you know, he kind of tried to... That's how we named our interaction. And both Marisol and I were like, we're not heated. We were just having a lively conversation and we disagreed. And so it was actually pretty, I found it funny because I'm like, oh, and it was a Canadian white man. And so the notion that two women of color were having a, you know, we're both loud and just kind of going back and forth, he thought we were in a conflict or thought, Santa, do you remember that? And it just struck me as funny that I had to, both of us were like, yeah, no, we're good. This is just, this is how we talk and we could disagree. And that doesn't have to be even perceived as a conflict.
Yeah, I do remember that. That was hilarious. And I feel like that happens a lot, right? Like in churches and stuff too, where the white culture in the church expects you to talk and speak in a different way in there, like them. And so when they see someone being loud or see someone talking in a tone that's louder than theirs, they're like, oh my God, tension. So yeah, I feel like that is something that came out too in this Laredo Fall Con with how the tone monitoring was happening. And I mean, you sounded frustrated and upset, but you didn't sound that frustrated and upset. So I, Aisha, at least. And so it was funny how, you know, I think there were different points in that facilitation on Saturday morning that was surprising to me. One of them was how they were trying to kind of speak to your tone and try to tone monitor you and Marisol. And I found it really disturbing the way they did it when it came to Jessica York standing up and speaking. And it was very disrespectful. And so that was, yeah, so it was a mix of things there that were shocking in how they were trying to facilitate and trying to impose their own perspective, their own tone onto others in what was a very silencing technique. But going back to this idea of like decentering whiteness and centering multiculturalism, is that, I'm still like, I mean, I think I want to talk more about that. I'm interested in knowing more about what it means to center multiculturalism and how is that different from what people have been doing in the UUA for the last few years with trying to center multiculturalism through programming, through training, youth of color doing the multicultural leadership school and things like that? And why is this coming up now as centering multiculturalism, and what has not worked in the past that has led to this year, the fallout this year in the denomination? So different. So I guess my questions are like around that, like, is centering multiculturalism something new? Because I don't see it as something new. I see it as something that's always been worked on.
No, I think you're right. That I think it's because it's been worked on in the ways that you just named, that we had the spring of 2017. I think that as we continue to center multiculturalism and decenter whiteness, we're now seeing the pushback from that, right? At least in my opinion, we're seeing the organization and not just UU, I think, you know, we could see it more nationally as well. You're seeing the rubber band effect of the culture trying to snap back to that more comfort to them, to a white-centered culture, more comfortable shape. And so as it tries to snap back, continuing to find new ways to center that multiculturalism is really important. So I don't think we would even be here if you all, I didn't do a lot of those things, hadn't been doing what you're doing. There's just no way, because that's the expanding, right? That's the pulling of that elastic. And yeah, go ahead.
I think part of what was happening and what led to the white supremacy teach-in and the events at the Religious Professionals of Color retreat, Finding Our Way Home, to me, Sana, is exact. Okay, so the Multicultural Leadership School for Youth and Young Adult has been happening for what, the last 10 years, maybe, you know, eight or nine years. And what happened in the last 8 years before Susan Frederick Gray is what I witnessed happening is most of the multicultural work was coming out of the youth and young adult office, and multicultural growth and witness absolutely supported Finding Our Way Home. And it was, I perceived from the outside looking in that it was siloed, and it was not, Leadership Council had Peter Morales and Taquina Boston. Everyone else was white, as we had already named in the spring. All the leader, regional leads and congregational life staff and the director of congregational life staff were all white. So it wasn't, to me, it was the UUA rubber, you know, the rubber bands of what was happening in with the UUA is, yes, there was some multicultural stuff going on. It was not holistic or integrated into the system. And I worked at the UUA when Bill Sinkford was there. And it wasn't quite as siloed, and there was an attempt to have multiculturalism or multicultural centering be more integrated. So Sana, I hear what you know. What I think happened, or at least what I perceived, is it was not centered to what we were doing. It was just, here's a box, let's check it off. So that was the disappointment for me, is that we were 100 people almost, or 100 at Finding Our Way Home in, where were we? Baltimore in March. And most of the room were seminarians and ministers. The religious educators, musicians, administrators are not the majority of the people who attend that that gathering. And so we're saying to folks of color, hey, go to seminary, hey, be a religious professional, and here's your ceiling. You can only get so far. You can be the assistant to the assistant minister to a white person, or you could maybe be part of congregational life staff, maybe. But if you do, then you're not going to get to be one of the leads. So that's where, to me, the problem was, is that we can say, listen, we're great at words. We're Unitarians, right? We love words. We love putting words together. What does it look like to actually integrate and internalize those words? So that, does that answer your question, Santa? Like, cause I don't think this is, I don't see what Christina presented as something different. It's rather what was hopeful to me about what happened at Lareda is putting into practice what we've been talking about. And especially in light of the teach-in, it's like, you know what, we can't keep doing this, especially in light of what's going on nationally. If we as Unitarian Universalists who say we want to affirm so many good things in the world can't do this together, I don't know what to say. Like, I think we're kind of toast. I don't know.
As far as our next moves, I think looking at Christina's slide, there's some vetting out that needs to happen. So you mentioned Thrive or Multicultural Leadership School. So now I've had the opportunity to work together as facilitators and work with youth, and something that, and opportunities that we like to provide them is to not to minimally focus on whiteness, period. Right, the work that we're being asked to do, if you're going to say multicultural centering, which I feel like is such a broad umbrella, and so you, it's going to take more vetting out to actually speak to what we're talking about. And I would also say that our concepts and understandings of multiculturalism are a white construct. They're always sort of in relation to whiteness, but is to work with the youth, to, you know, so they can have a sense of cultural pride and celebration. Everything, all that is not always about reacting to whiteness and having to prove oneself. Yes, that is a part of the package, but it is not sort of the main part. An opportunity for them to focus on other ways in which we internalize hegemony. So what are our class backgrounds? How does that interplay with the shades and the color of our skin and how we are treated, are favored or not favored in the UU community. I mean, for me, one of the most heartbreaking examples in working with youth around their cultural identity was to have a young dark-skinned African-American girl cry in one of our anti-racism trainings, talking about how based on the sight of her, the assumption is that she is going to be a mean person, right? And this is like a 13 or 14 year old, right? Saying that this is the way in which she is being perceived and how that is affecting her self-esteem. And so at a venue, as finding our way home or any other times when we gather at General Assembly, for us to take the time to do our own work, to talk about the complexities of our identities, to give the voice in a big movement, at least in pop culture, mainstream culture, is a lot of folks of African descent who are also Latino lifting that up and challenging lighter skin or white skin Latinos to say that, you know, we have culture, we are here, like these are ways in which our culture is being appropriated and we're sort of being ignored and denied in under the guise of we're all sort of multicultural, we're all this, you know, it's like, no, we are sort of needing to take our place or highlight what our cultural contributions have been.
So yeah, in a way it would be holding, I mean, multicultural, if you were to center multiculturalism, it would be also about holding ourselves accountable. And, you know, if you want everyone in one, under one umbrella, this broad umbrella of multiculturalism, holding people, the POCs within the group, accountable to each other too. And that's a larger conversation for another day too. But I think that's one thing to think about. And the other thing is, like, I have a question about the larger picture, like, what would Lareda look like if it was centering multiculturalism, right? If that was the case, because one thing I saw at Lareda this fall was that not many voices of color were like dismissed in terms of feedback months in advance. The board wasn't really that diverse, and that more diversity existed on the diversity committee. Is that what it was called?
Diversity and inclusion.
Yeah, diversity and inclusion committee. Then there were on actual leadership positions. And that speaks to tokenizing, you know, like you're going to tokenize POC and put them on the diversity and inclusion committee, but not have them on the board or other places. So like, I think there's a lot of work to do in even just a lot of pre-work to do before even thinking about centering multiculturalism.
And how whiteness affects the larger system, right? How, what are our systems issues in Laredo? And even as a professional organization, how are we centering folks that are the most vulnerable in their jobs or the most vulnerable in our larger community, as opposed to figuring out how we can sort of join the monarchy, how we can also get power, right? There's such a focus, there's such a rush to see how we can get power. Folks will say how we can have a voice, you know, and are we really thinking about folks that may not even be in the room at all, or folks who are having real issues in the congregations that they serve and they can't make it to Laredo, so we don't ever hear their stories.
Mm-hmm. And I think, and that's a really important point, because I also think it touches on the issues around, again, not just the professional development funds, but like, I mean, there were people at Laredo whose professional development funds were just $200, and it took a lot more to get to Laredo. And I see it as a problem of classism as well as other things, but that's something that's not been talked about, that is really critical to like how we want to center multiculturalism, is who has access to scholarships, but also how are religious educators being paid, and they're still not being paid well, even if the UUA has guidelines for how they should be paid. And that to me is a systemic problem of classism in the Unitarian Universalist world.
Yeah. What mechanisms are we going to use to broaden access and give people the opportunity to contribute to the conversation and help in the decision making? Like Christina's summary statement, she said she talked with other people. There are other folks that help contribute to that statement and to those words, and she didn't do it the usual way of I'm going to go over here and do this by myself.
Yeah.
And I think that's right there was so important, India, because I asked at least five other people, and I was one of them, folks to get input, because there's no way that I can possibly experience everything at FallCon. Like, I'm not everywhere. And I'm seeing it through a different lens than other people. And so I think that voice thing that you mentioned, India, is super important to me, because I think that those voices have different lenses, and those lenses bring a different lived experience, right, to the room that is so necessary. Like, if you don't have a different lived experience, different lived experiences in the room, how could you possibly know what's missing, right? And I think I sometimes I get so chicken and the egg. I'm like, which do we do first, right? And then I remember we don't have to like exactly do anything first. We can do several of these things at the same time, because yeah, I absolutely want to have different voices. And yeah, I absolutely also want to be working on making sure that we're finding out who do we even know isn't even at the table that should be at the table, because we don't even know that they're like having issues, right?
No. And does the room or does the table even allow for that?
Right.
Systems issues of looking at the structures and how the structures are not ultimately serving whatever our end goal is, whatever our vision is, whatever our mission is, right? And actually having to, as you're saying, decenter, deconstruct, right? And not use those structures, not use that room, not use that table anymore, right? Because it doesn't serve us.
Yeah. And so my question is does it take getting some of our voices to the table in order to deconstruct that table? Because that's the part I struggle with, because I think, like, I struggle with, am I affirming the structure that's in place by coming to the table?
Yeah.
In an attempt to deconstruct it. Like, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And I think that's really, it's an important question. I also think when we talk about who's at the table and who's not there, in and diversity of voices represented, it's also important to question, are they the same diverse voices that are always at the table asking, you know? And there is a thing where religious educators of color are falling through the cracks because we don't even know they exist at churches, right? Like, they haven't been able to connect with larger, like the UUA or Lareda. So, like, how are we, I guess, bringing in voices and making sure people are being connected to the connections they need to be connected to, and also empowering new leadership to come in? Because I think that's one strategic thing that's really important, is the same leadership of diverse voices can be asking for the same things, or, you know, asking for a change. But the more diversity we see, the more people we see, more new leadership coming in and saying, yeah, this is a problem. And then another wave of new leadership coming in and saying, yeah, this is a problem. I think it builds momentum and a movement for change that shows that we're not going to stop asking for what we want and need. So I think that's something to think about too, and how, who is at the table and who's not there, and how we are affirming the system and how we're not. I think those are important questions.
I think one of the things that to me is so exciting about Black Lives of Unitarian Universalism, you know, Shirley Chisholm said, if there's not a seat at the table, bring a folding chair. And so what to me is hopeful and inspiring about the Blue Collective is, people have been pointing out what's wrong in terms of how Unitarian Universalism has not been welcoming to people of color since 1961, probably the next day after the merger was settled. So it's not that I disagree, Senna, it's that that hasn't been the issue of pointing out what's wrong. Books have been written about it. People have made it their entire careers. Black minister theologians have made it their careers to point out what's wrong with Unitarian Universalism. So I think at this point, it's kind of what was the last Star Wars movie, The Last Jedi? We're not going to win by fighting what we hate, but protecting what we love, saving what we love. So at this point, it's like, that's what I see. What I tell people is, I went to the Blue convening in March, and 3 days later, I went to Finding Our Way Home. And because I saw the possibility of not only whiteness decentered, but a completely, it wasn't even the same room, let alone the same table, let alone the same chairs. It was like, oh, Unitarian Universalism, and it was messy, it was joyful, it was, you know, there was just a whole, like, oh, if we don't use the same tables, we can actually imagine something that really can be, fulfill something that we've kind of been at the edges, and we see little sparks of it. The other thing that we haven't mentioned that I really feel the need to say, so over the years, I've been a religious educator for just about 15 years now. And the second day on the job, people, oh, you're going to seminary? Oh, you're going to seminary? You're going to be a minister? You're going to seminary? As if I'm lacking. I'm not enough. I'm not worthy, because our whole system, and I appreciate Reverend Meg Riley, I appreciate almost Reverend Santa Saeed, it is not at all to diminish your calling. And it is a personal calling, and it's wonderful. And our entire UUA system affirms that track of leadership completely disproportionately to anything else, to anything else. So that's why religious education, when someone declares they are a seminarian, no matter what race they are, what cultural ethnicity, they are immediately taken under the wing of an entire department at the UUA. We don't have that for anybody else. So that's something that when we talk systemically, we need to really say, what is it going to take to genuinely change the paradigm? And I think like I said, there are plenty of books that we can look to that already point this out. I think we need to, I would love to learn, I look to the folks at Blue to say, teach me, you know, I want to learn how to do this. And I get very frustrated. I want to name this, and this is POC, taking responsibility. I've heard non-Black POC kind of like diss Blue, and I'm like, oh, hell to the no. If you all are upset that Blue got $5 million, then ask Leslie Mack and Lena Gardner how to do this. Don't diss that. This is where we don't do ourselves a disservice as people of color. I can go on and on. I'm going to be quiet now. Thank you all.
And so as you're saying, listening and taking stock of the current examples that already exist, I mean, that we are not, as they say, recreating the wheel. Blue is an example. Drum has been an example for many years. And I know now they're working, Marisol is working on the Global Majorities Collective. Our youth communities and the way that their decision-making at one point was to use consensus, right? That's a very different model of decision-making than Robert's Rules of Order. There are examples, both global examples and local examples, of how we are able to move forward in more of a holistic manner, right? And not in a way that's hegemonic and not in a way that's oppressive, but still contending with the fact that we have our own internalized oppression and we are bringing, you know, our own baggage. And so also looking at the spiritual disciplines and the spiritual practices that have been really lifted up in the past few years, you know, giving folks grace or allowing for grace and other practices that allow us to communicate. Direct communication for me is a spiritual practice, right? That's a spiritual practice. I think because I come from a Christian background, the sort of theological examples that are provided throughout, whether they be in parables, whether they be in Psalms, or really being said, you know, a child will lead us, right? What does that mean? Like looking to leadership and listening from folks in places that we're not taught to expect it from.
Mm-hmm. Oh, amen. That last portion I need to write down. Look for leadership in places we're taught not to expect it from. I can remember it. It's so true. It's exactly it.
One thing I would also add is there is this, and I totally feel the frustration about like RE professionals not being seen as a legit. It's not being seen as a legit profession. It's not being seen as legit leadership within Unitarian Universalism, and that is a giant frustration. And I think what goes hand in hand with being a seminarian and going on this ordination track is my RE experience is not considered enough for I don't know how the MFC is going to do it in the future, but it's not seen as enough.
And how long have you been a religious educator?
Since 2009. So that's not counted. Yeah, and that's involved pastoral care for youth and children. So I think that is something that came out in the GA when we were giving feedback to the MFC when they were asking for it, was that quite a number of the young seminarians of color were RE professionals while they're going through seminary. And so in part, we were griping about the fact that we don't get paid enough. But then the other part is that we're spending a lot of money on this process of becoming ministers, and that the MFC is not taking our experiences, RE professionals, seriously. And that needs to be changed, frankly, if we're going to be strengthening and trying to recenter the RE profession. So,
amen. Amen. There's absolutely no reason that religious educators who've been in religious education for 25 years should not be, in my opinion, should not be ordained clergy. I think they should be.
Or should have to follow parallel tracks that are not recognized in any other world except Unitarian Universalism. Yep. You know, that just has pissed me off for years. That's frankly why I jumped tracks, because I thought, That's how I called it as a white girl. You know, I was like, I know these rules, and I didn't come out as a lesbian to follow them. So I imagine people of color see them, you know, in different ways than I do very much, but oppressive rules.
Well, thank you all so much. We've just got a couple minutes more. Is there anything that hasn't been said that, I mean, there's a whole other view about MFC and religious education credentialing in it. But anything, last words on Laurie de Falcon or decentering whiteness or multicultural centering?
Yeah, I just want to express gratitude for everyone that sort of took the conversation that we had with the board and planning team forward and helped transform that space. I know that it was like beneficial for a lot of folks that were there. And I know that a lot of the professionals in the space, many people of color and some white folks, really gave so much, right? So much of themselves, so much of their time to make that programming happen. So I'm really grateful for that.
And I want to express the same gratitude. And I think while I was in the room, I was also at the same time following some really exceptional leadership that was attempting to do really hard work. And I saw how hard and difficult it was. And so I'm really grateful for the movement, the leadership. And I really want to give a shout out to like Marisol Caballero, who led the POC caucus group and invested a lot of energy into what happened in redirecting Lareda, Erica Shadowsong, and also Elizabeth Wen. Some really amazing leadership that we have, including you both as well, yeah. Christina and Aisha. Thank you.
Thank you both for being here. And we didn't get to exactly what happened with the restorative justice circles, but I thought it was more important to talk about the decentering whiteness and multicultural centering. And that there are, you know, lots of folks out there who participated in this racial justice or restorative justice circles that could speak to that. So thank you both. Really appreciate it. Thanks, everybody. And we'll see you next week.
This has been an episode of The View. If you would like to learn more about the CLF, visit questformeaning.org.